This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Shazana Mukhtar. 20 years after the September 11 terror attacks and the subsequent US invasion of Afghanistan, the Taliban are back in Kabul and governing the country once again. The US is just the latest in a long line of foreign powers that have tried and failed to mold Afghanistan into their desired version of statehood. How will history remember the US occupation of Afghanistan? Joining me to reflect on the recent developments is Tamim Ansari, writer and author of Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. Tamim, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
As an Afghan-American who witnessed the rise of the Taliban in the 1990s, the American invasion that ousted them from power in 2001, and now the return of the Taliban to government in Afghanistan, how are you personally feeling about these developments?
Well, I'm very shook up. I think all Afghans outside the country and inside the country are shook up and we're tormented. But, you know, this is the 40th year of the war. For us, it didn't start 20 years ago. It started in 78, and there's been constant war ever since then. So that little four-year period when the Taliban ruled last was actually not the very worst time in these 40 years. Probably the worst time was the 4 years before that, when there was a civil war in the cities where, you know, just 10,000 rockets a day coming into Kabul. So then, you know, when the Taliban first took over, my relatives that were in Kabul, they were even a little bit relieved because the war did kind of stop then. I was in Afghanistan right after the Taliban were ousted. You know, I went to Kabul. And I can say that at that point, the people in Kabul were just delighted that America had come because they thought the war was over. It turned out the war wasn't over outside of the cities. In the last 20 years, we've settled into the same pattern we've seen again and again in Afghanistan. A foreign power holding the cities and the countryside, an insurgency that's countrywide fighting against the city. So that's been kind of the story of the last 20 years. Here in America and in most of the world, kind of was the forgotten war. It's not just the forever war, it's the forgotten war. You rarely saw coverage of the things that happened out there in the countryside in this war. So I think that what happened in the last couple of months had been coming for a long time. You know, this war was not ending. It wasn't winding down. You know, the Taliban had, you might say, a campaign plank that appealed to most Afghans, which is, we're going to end the war. Now, have they ended the war? I think we have to wait and see. I'm not sure that the story is over.
So one of the revelations for me in reading your writings and just understanding better the developments in Afghanistan is the fact that the Taliban were born from Afghan refugees in the previous conflicts that you mentioned. The displacement from their homeland actually gave them a convincing nationalism narrative. But from what you're saying as well, it feels like the Taliban is still foreign to Afghanistan. How do you see them?
Well, let me put it this way. You know, before all of this stuff, certainly Afghanistan regarded itself as the most Muslim country, you know. But Afghan Islam was very heterogeneous. It was very Sufi flavored. What Afghans considered Islam probably had a lot of tribal customs and social customs of the area sewn into it. It was, however, the thing that all Afghans could hold in common, because Afghanistan is a country with you know, three major languages, at least 12 other languages, many ethnic groups, but everybody was Muslim. And during that period when I was growing up, although, you know, there were Shias and Sunnis and people are always talking about that, most of the time it's like, oh, we're all Muslims, but also we're all Afghans. So there is an Afghan nationalism that somebody could appeal to. The Taliban, that core of it that were the refugees that grew up in the camps in Pakistan and lived perhaps among the worst childhoods on earth. Yes, they genetically they're Afghans, but the conditions in which they grew up were nothing like the Afghanistan of the centuries up until the Soviet invasion. And then they were organized into the Taliban by political interests in Pakistan. So that's there too. So now the Taliban are in Kabul, but the question remains, who are the Taliban? There are some that are the Taliban from the camps. There is, many people say, I have no independent way to judge this, but I think it's probably true. There is a great deal of influence from Pakistan, power in Kabul. And then there's people like this Haqqani network. They're not the Taliban. They're like the tribal Pashtuns of the border area who have prospered essentially as a kind of a mafia or a criminal gang up there. And they're very powerful in this government. Who is actually in control in Kabul? I don't think they know yet. I think it's going to take a while to sort all this out.
You've been very cognizant of the different narratives and perspectives of Afghans, primarily between the inward-looking rural Afghanistan and the outward-looking urban Afghanistan. Is it too simplistic, though, to say that the rural folks support the Taliban and the urban folks don't? Is that dichotomy accurate, or is there more nuances to that?
There are nuances to that, although I think in general, that's a generalization that, yes, you could make. I think it's the case that, there is a culture, the roots of which go back to village Afghanistan and also nomad Afghanistan. So that culture is the inward-looking one. And if you see a tribe of nomads travel, they're kind of gone now, but if you saw a tribe of nomads traveling across the landscape in the old days, what you saw were men on the outside, you know, big dogs protectively there. Then the women and children were on the inside. They were moving. It was a natural social kind of, you know, strategy for a tribal people because the enemies, they were ready for the outside world. You know, that was almost like a physical metaphor for the Afghan social life. And it was recapitulated in the villages. The Chaudhari, which in the West is always called the Burqa for some reason, you know, that was a feature of the cities, not of the traditional countryside so much, because in the villages, everybody was more or less related. They all knew each other. They were all insiders. It was when strangers came that then there was this thing about, oh, the outside world mustn't see the women, you know, protect the women. So that was this whole kind of social, cultural life thing going on. And that part of it in the cities, you know, in my family growing up, the women all wore chaudharis when they went out. So it's not like the Taliban brought this. This is a centuries old feature of Afghan life. But it isn't the case that everybody in the city is urban and modern and wants Western lifestyles. I think there's still a lot of traditional kind of orientation towards social values, towards, for example, dating or arranged marriages or things like that. In the cities, there's still a lot of people who are oriented that way. It's also not true that all of the people who are conservative in that way are illiterate and uneducated. Mm. You know, there are people who have education who aren't like that. But the rhythm of Afghan history is such that if you're going to be the government of that country, you're going to have to deal with the outside world. You know, the outside powers are always going to be there trying to get in. So the government has to have the savvy and the sophistication to deal with those people. But on the other hand, they're not going to be the government for very long unless the people on the inside say, okay, you are the protectors of the Afghan way of life. So when they point inward, they have to represent themselves as the most, you know, Muslim, Afghan, nationalist, tribal people you could imagine. They're always in that position. And I would say if somehow this Taliban government gets normalized and settles into place, and if it lasts, let's say, 10 years or whatever, 20 years, by the end of that time, you're going to see that same pattern reemerging. They're going to be out in the world as sophisticated world people. But in the inside, when they come back home, it'll be like, oh, yes, those outsiders were not them. And also, it matters who the outside world is, because for the last couple of hundred years, there's been the imperialist West coming in. That's been the outside world. That picture is changing too. So that's going to have an effect on how things go in Afghanistan.
I want to touch on how you've described Afghan culture and politics, which you've likened to a traditional Afghan game of buzkashi, where leaders gain followers and establish a relationship through being generous and incurring obligations. So reading this description reminded me so much of patronage politics in Malaysia. And and in some ways, this is viewed negatively by Western ideals. You know, it's at odds with values like integrity, transparency. I mean, this kind of arrangement is seen as fostering corruption. How accurate is that perception of Afghan politics, do you think?
I think that's a very interesting point you bring up, because it is absolutely true that there is some form of patronage politics that was the way of life in Afghanistan going back traditionally. And it's linked to the social value that you take care of your family and your people, whoever they are. And in Afghan culture, one of the main ways that you establish authority and build prestige, it's A, by being incredibly articulate in meetings. You know, language is really important. And then also the social graces, which largely include extravagant generosity. So this kind of aggressive hospitality thing means that if in the traditional system, if you've got a position in government, then it's because you had a large network of people who saw you as their champion or their, you know, the guy with the most prestige, but you were not going to keep that unless you just doled out magnificently, so that the thing that people call corruption was actually a way in which the wealth seeped through the figures who are in the government to all the people behind. But in this 20-year period with the Americans, two things. One is that they said, if you have the power to give money for a village or something, can't give it to your village. That would be corruption. You have to find a way where you're not involved. Give it to somebody that's completely, well, for an Afghan, it's like, what's wrong with you? You're not helping your people. You're just helping a bunch of strangers. And then if the guy says, no, no, don't talk to me. Fill out a form. Come to the, that's the way it's done in the West, but in the East, that's looked at as there's just something, you know, embarrassingly wrong about that. So that was a just one small way in which the attempt to bring a Western-style government and bureaucracy to a country that A, had this culture, but B, the culture had been eviscerated by the war in the Soviet period. So there was both of those factors. And now you have people in government who have no patronage networks to support. When they take the money that is available, they put it directly to Dubai in real estate. You know, it didn't go to any network inside the country. So now that really did become corruption.
I'm speaking to Afghan-American writer and author Tamim Ansari on why the U.S.-led nation-building exercise failed to take root in Afghanistan. More from this conversation after the break. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Thanks for staying tuned to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Shazana Mokhtar, and I'm speaking to writer Tamim Ansari, author of the book Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. There's an ongoing postmortem and soul-searching over what was gained from the past 20 years. What do you think were the gains, Tamim? And do you see Afghanistan hence losing those gains now that the Taliban are back in power?
They're going to lose some of those gains. And I think it is actually legitimately true that there was a body of people who have grown up. They were born in this period, or they were just very young when it started. You know, if they were like 3 years old or 4 years old. So there is a whole generation of young people who've come of age in the cities who were able to do things like get an education, you know, explore their interests in anything they might, you know, you can name like music, theater. They set up coffee shops. They had poetry readings. They had all of those kinds of things. Judo, there was women who went to the Olympics. There were a lot of people who got a lot of opportunities that were very good things. And some of that is going to be lost. A lot of the gains that women made are going to be lost because these people who have come in, whatever they said about we've changed and grown, now that they're in power, they're not going to do it. I'm guessing. But the thing is, there is that large group of people. In fact, the ones who have come now to Kabul and taken power, they are under pressure to actually be a government now. And a government has to do things. So if you are doing things that you cannot get actual support from the bulk of the people who are in the city where your government is operating, you know, you're 10,000 people in a group surrounded by 5 million who've grown up in this other culture. Well, then I think either you're going to have to negotiate in some way, and I was hoping that that would be what would start happening right away, or it's going to be violence. And I hate to see that because the civil war period was just horrendous. You know, there is the resistance movement that's based now in Tajikistan, and the leader of it is the son of the great Ahmad Shah Massoud, and he himself is a smart, articulate, admirable guy. But I don't feel like comfortable with wanting him to start the war again. So, so for people like me, there's a big emotional and mental conflict about where to stand on all this.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you have opinions on how the international community should deal with the Taliban and whether the Taliban should be accepted as the legitimate government moving forward that foreign powers then negotiate with, or should they be isolated given what we know of their ideology and policies?
Well, the trouble with isolating them is that whatever there is to eat, they will eat. You know, if you hold power in a government, the people with all the power and all the guns are going to get whatever there is. So starving the Taliban isn't really starving the Taliban. It's starving Afghan people. And I think there is considerable reason to worry about the possibility of hunger and all of the ills that come out of poverty, that disease with COVID rampant. Now, who's going to be able to do anything about that? I feel like, okay, I'll just say what I think. You know, it's like, I feel like it's time to say, look, that didn't work, you know, for the international community, for NATO and the United States. What to do now is to start to rebuild the idea that you're a good guy to the Afghan people, you know, so to be complicit and the starving of the Afghans is not a good look for you. Please, right from the beginning, if only that could have been what they did in 2002, 2003, just come in and say, look, we're not here to change your culture. You take care of that. But we're here to, what do you need? Instead, you know, the national community came in and said, we know what you need. You need a $5 billion power plant put right here. You know, then that money came in and somebody got it, and there was a power plant at the end of it. But I think it might have been better to just kind of stand by and be a helping hand without having a plan. Let Afghans plan their own future. That's what I would have thought.
And then I suppose without judgment as well, which may be hard to do for Western powers and their many ideals. But okay, turning our attention to perceptions of Islam in the U.S., where you live and where you're based. How much influence has the 20-year Afghan war had on the perceptions of Islam and Muslims among Americans? I mean, has there been an evolution of how notions of Islam and the Muslim diaspora are viewed in the U.S. as a result?
I once said, and I said, and now I've seen this phrase come up other places. I think I came up with it. The U.S. went into Afghanistan to make it more like America. And what happened instead was America became more like Afghanistan. You know, this country has also divided into this urban and rural kind of split. And I think that one problem has been that the left rallied to the war in Afghanistan and regarded it as a good war because there was the perception that it was saving Afghan women from this thing that was represented by and the West saw as so abominable. But I think the left of the West didn't really understand the cultural aspect of that. They saw, they position the conditions of women in Muslim society and Afghan society in particular in their own context and said, would I like to live that life? Ooh, I don't want to. Let's go save those people. So on the left, although it was situated as a good war, it was built on a hatred of Afghan culture. And then on the right, it was, those are the guys that knocked down 9/11 and they're not Christians. You know, we hate them. So from both sides, unfortunately, found a way to think of themselves as noble in prosecuting this war while fueling it with hatred at both ends. That's been the tragedy for Afghanistan. And I think something of that is the case for Islam as a whole. I think, you know, there was just a report here that Muslims in America and Muslim women in particular here in the Bay Area, they are experiencing a great deal of Islamophobia and that kind of judgmental projection from just the people they meet. This is only one of several cases, you know, the Islam and the Western secular world and then the Western Christian world or whatever that is. So this is just one case where there are not instances where people can just actually have conversations with one another in the same room and then start to not see each other as that thing, you know, but to be working on some single thing together. That's, you know, that there's no opportunity for that, or very few.
And you wrote in your book, Destiny Disrupted, that the conflict racking the modern world is not a clash of civilizations, but it's more of a friction generated by two mismatched world histories intersecting. If this is the case, how then do we smooth these frictions between the West and the Muslim world?
Well, I think now it's part of a bigger story. You know, these two world histories overlapped and they ground together. But now there's further developments in that grinding together. One of the main ones of which was the huge surge of refugees starting in 2015 out of the Muslim world into Europe and to some much smaller degree to America. When that started, I had such a sinking feeling. I just felt like, man, this is going to be really hard to recover from this, because the thing that it triggered was a right wing, close the gates, shut the walls, keep those others out. So it exacerbated the emotion of otherness on both sides. So how are we going to get past that? But in the larger sense, you know, we used to be, whatever our problems with one another as communities, we were living in separate places. You know, technology was such that we had societies that were not all up inside each other's business. What's happening now because of globalization and the role of technology in that is that everybody is everywhere. And, you know, what's happening in Uganda or Malaysia or Afghanistan or Venezuela or whatever, I wake up and it's all in my face every morning, and there's nothing I can do about most of it, but the emotions that I have about most of it, I can't shut out. I think this is a transitional phase between what we were and what we someday will be, I think, I hope, which is a global human self. You know, we have to find some way to recognize that the self-interest that drives us, and it does, that's the case for everybody. Self-interest drives us. The thing that we need to do is to harness the energy of self-interest to a self that's bigger than this country, this little movement, that religion. Harness self-interest to the self that is all of us, all of humanity. So the first part of that, the narratives that knit us together into little clumps that were just ourselves and we saw, of course, they have to unravel somewhat before a new and bigger narrative can form. I am hoping and thinking we are in the transitional phase between all of our separate narratives and some future and hopefully not too distant future time when we are starting to put together a new story about the adventures of all humanity, you know, the quest of all humanity.
Tamim, I think on that very idealistic view of the future, one that's definitely attractive and hopeful. I think that's where we'll end our conversation today. Thank you so much for speaking with me and sharing your insights and thoughts.
All right. Thank you so much for inviting me.
I've been speaking to Tamim Ansari, an author and historian. He's the writer of Games Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. Tamim was a speaker at the 2021 Khazanah Mega Trends Forum this October. You've been listening to The Breakfast Grill, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.